In this order on the program today, consumers, bank regulations, and a long, long walk. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 28th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A very quick check of the economic calendar tells us we're going to get an update from the University of Michigan this week on consumer sentiment. A quick check of economic news tells us that consumer sentiment or confidence or the general consumer mood or however you would like to phrase it is one of the big puzzles of the past couple of years. Why do we feel so lousy about this economy despite a labor market that just keeps on going? That's the question Catherine Rampell and her colleagues at the Washington Post set out to answer. Catherine is, of course, one of our Friday regulars. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
So tell us, first of all, what you did briefly, and then more importantly, what you found.
So there's been this puzzle, essentially, or at least I have considered it a puzzle. Why has unemployment remained near record lows? Job growth keeps chugging along, et cetera, all the things you just mentioned. And yet consumers are so dour. And depending on what media you consume, the answer is obviously the economy is great or obviously the economy is terrible. And yet, you know, the indicators are kind of all pointing in different directions. So we set out to try to figure out how people are actually experiencing inflation, what the headline numbers might be missing. For example, if you just look at percentage changes in wage growth versus percentage changes in prices, that doesn't necessarily tell you the whole story because low-income people in particular spend a lot more than they earn. So even if they're both growing at whatever 5%, that doesn't necessarily mean that they actually have more dollars coming in than out or that it's even a wash. So we basically looked at a bunch of data with the help of the Penn Wharton budget model and also interviewed a lot of families around the country who agreed to provide receipts through this receipt scanning app because we figured, you know, people's memories are fuzzy.
Yeah, got to bring the receipts. And what you found out is forget percentages, actual dollars out the door are what's driving a lot of things here.
Yes. So we kind of had two headline findings. One is that if you actually look under the hood, it does look like lower income people in particular are worse off than they were a year ago on average. You know, obviously there are exceptions, which is not, again, what the headline numbers might indicate because low income workers have had their wages rise the most in percentage terms. But again, that's not everything. The other headline finding we had was one that's a bit harder to quantify, which is that if you're just looking at dollars coming in and out, that doesn't necessarily tell you the whole story because inflation comes with all this other baggage, like how much more time people have to spend comparison shopping and deciding what to cut from their budget, triangulating trips to different gas stations, et cetera. And that came out more in the interviews where people talked about almost the mental tax of inflation that may not be captured with the dollar figures alone.
It is a huge mental tax. The stress that some of your respondents sort of alluded to was kind of amazing.
Yeah, it was very striking. Everybody talked about the hard decisions they've had to make for what to cut from their budgets so that they're not over budget, essentially, week to week. And then a lot of them talked about, you know, just the exhaustion of having to make the multiple trips to different grocery stores or decide, well, how do we temper Thanksgiving? Like one family I spoke with, a lower income family, they normally celebrate Thanksgiving with a turkey. They said, yeah, maybe this year we will just defrost one of the frozen pork loins that's already in the freezer. So, you know, these are the kinds of details that I hope give people a little bit more empathy about like how big of a challenge it has been for many families to deal with inflation, even amidst rapid job growth, abundant job offers rather out there.
One of the things you and I and the rest of our crew talk about on Fridays is how long consumers can conceivably keep on going because consumers have been driving this economy for a very, very long time. You read between the lines on this survey, and we've got less than a minute left. It does not seem like they can keep driving things too terribly much longer.
Well, if you look at other data, it does suggest that people are drawing down their savings. That we didn't get into that in this piece. But yeah, I mean, there's only so much money that they have available. There's only so much more trading down they can do from Cheerios to the off-brand, Toasted O's or whatever it is. Whatever adaptations people have had to make, they're running out of additional tools, and they're just going to have to stop spending as much. And, that's not going to be fun either. Obviously, if there's a recession and people lose their incomes altogether, not just that their incomes aren't keeping up with prices, that will be even worse.
Catherine Rempell and her colleagues at the Washington Post on consumers and why we feel the way they do on that website today. Catherine, thank you so much. Good to talk to you. Not on a Friday.
Thanks, Kai.
See ya. Wall Street on this, what is it, Tuesday? Traders spend most of the day just trying to decide how they feel about things. Slightly negative, it turns out. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Two things about this next story by way of setup. Number one, there was a big Senate hearing on bank supervision today. The Fed was there, the FDIC, and Treasury. I think we mentioned this the other day. The postmortems on SVB have begun. Number two, we try real hard around here not to repeat content, not without a real good reason anyway, which today we have. So from today's hearing, Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to submit for the record an article interview with Mr. Tarullo from Marketplace that he specifically says in here, 2155 is likely or impossible to be a root cause of the problem. I'm paraphrasing. He was saying it looks like a regulatory and supervisory lapse.
2155 there is a reference to the 2018 rollback of some of those Dodd-Frank reforms that you've heard so much about the last 3 weeks. But the Tarullo reference is what caught our ear. Dan Tarullo, who sat on the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors for almost 9 years and who was on this program 2 weeks ago talking about those supervisory and regulatory lapses. Here you go. All right. So look, that's why we got you on the phone. You ran, among other things you did at the Fed while you were there, you ran the Committee on Supervision and Regulation. And I am not the first person to ask, nor will I be the first person to ask, where were the regulators? Why did this come out of the blue?
Well, that's the huge question, isn't it? There are two places to look. One is to supervision and the other is to regulation. Now, of course, we're stipulating that there's a management failure, but I think everybody would agree with that. So in terms of the government, the debate publicly has been, gee, were the 2018-2019 changes in the law and Fed regulations respectively to blame? And as I think you know, I was opposed to both the law and the changes in the regulations, but I don't think there's that direct a connection between those specific changes and Silicon Valley. And so what that tells us is the failure was in the oversight by supervisors, people who were supposed to be watching whether things like the proportion of uninsured deposits was creating some unusual risks for that particular bank.
That's not terribly reassuring, I got to tell you.
No, it's not. And I think that the review that the Fed has launched, and it's significant that it's headed by the Vice Chair for Supervision, Michael Barr, who, as you know, is relatively new. I think the significance of having him run that rather than staff is precisely because they want to find out where the supervisory failures lay. Were they with the specific team that had responsibility for Silicon Valley, or were the failures more widespread in the sense that Washington was providing kind of a light touch supervisory direction to them?
What do you think?
I suspect that it's a combination of the two, but given the signals that the Fed was sending, in the last several years, I believe that part of it is just the don't be too tight in your supervision. You need to find legal problems before you tell the banks to change what they were doing.
Dan Tarullo on this program 2 weeks ago, late of the Fed, now of Harvard Law School. More SVB hearings in the House coming up tomorrow. There's a bill on California Governor Gavin Newsom's desk that he is expected to sign today that goes after oil companies, more specifically, oil companies suspected of price gouging. Perhaps not unexpected in a blue state where gas is, well, expensive. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has some of the legislative nuts and bolts on this one.
The average gallon of regular unleaded here in California costs $4.82. A lot. But it's about a dollar and a half cheaper than back in June.
We were being charged $2.60 above average, above any other state. That's highway robbery.
State Senator Nancy Skinner of Northern California introduced a bill that gives the state the power to investigate whether oil companies are gouging customers.
So the point of the data collection that's in this bill is to see, is there a legitimate reason if this happens again?
The state could fine oil companies if there's not. Chevron, which is based in California, opposed the bill. Ross Allen is a spokesperson.
It threatens to make price volatility even worse by discouraging refinery investment and doesn't address state supply shortages.
But there's more to it, says UC Berkeley Haas School of Business professor Severin Borenstein, who drives by two Chevron stations on his way to work. One charges around 70 cents more per gallon than the other.
It's not due to the cost of supplying gasoline at those two stations.
Borenstein, who's also a Newsom appointee to a body overseeing the state's electricity grid, says California has what he's taken to calling a mystery gasoline surcharge. Much of it seems to get added somewhere between the refinery and the gas station.
And that downstream sector has a lot of players in a web of relationships, and that's what needs to be investigated.
Borenstein says these mysteriously high gas prices are hitting consumers in Washington state and possibly Oregon, too. Kevin Slagle of the Western States Petroleum Association says California's proposal creates an unnecessary layer of bureaucracy.
You know, I don't think there are going to be many states that are going to want to rush into what was just passed.
Slagle says the law will just make the industry want to invest more outside of California, where it feels more welcome. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You become almost kind of biblical when you go on a walk like this.
300 miles will do that to a guy, I guess. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 37 points today, about a 10%, finished at 32,394. The NASDAQ gave up 52 points, about a 0.5%, 11,716. The S&P 500 subtracted 6 points, bit under 0.2% there, 39.71. Lily Jamali was just telling us about the oil industry. Had a pretty good Tuesday. Big oil did. Chevron gassed up 1.2%. ExxonMobil topped up 1.25%. Occidental Petroleum pumped up 4.3%. Shares in First Citizens Bank shares hit an all-time high today. The proud new owner of the assets of Silicon Valley Bank gained 2.3%. Bonds down, yields up, 10-year T-notes, 3.56%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are a long ways from the end of the SVB story. See also those congressional hearings I was talking about a second ago. But also, we're a long ways from the end of the practical banking industry knock-on effects of SVB. We talked yesterday about how all the regional bank stress could hurt commercial real estate. One natural follow-on to that is how all the regional bank stress could affect construction of said commercial real estate. Analysts at the financial services company Baird, which we should tell you was a Marketplace advertiser, said this week a slowdown in all non-residential construction was already likely even before SVB, now obviously even more so. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes is on that one.
From my window in southeast Baltimore, I can see two construction cranes. One's at a hospital, another working on a new office building. There's a third nearby at a marina. All those sites are considered non-residential construction.
Everything that we don't live in.
Anirban Basu is the chief economist at Associated Builders and Contractors, a trade group. Spending for non-residential projects is up nearly 16% in the past year, according to the Census Bureau. That's due in part to rising building costs. And if regional banks start limiting access to capital, financing for these projects could be harder to get.
Often it is the case that developers are tied to a regional bank, the bank they've been working with when they started their development firm, for instance. And so those regional banks are incredibly important.
Nearly 70% of commercial real estate loans are held by banks smaller than the top 25, according to the Federal Reserve. One of those institutions is Bay State Savings Bank in Western Massachusetts. Peter Alden is its president and CEO. He says the bank's lending hasn't been affected so far, but
the next 6 to 12 months could be very different than the last 6 to 12 months.
Alden says part of that is related to rising interest rates, which means the bank's customers may not be able to afford loans. He also says the cost of the Silicon Valley Bank failure will be passed on to all banks through the insurance premiums they pay to the FDIC.
We'll have to factor that in as well.
Another challenge for developers, finding enough workers. Ken Simonson is chief economist for the trade group Associated General Contractors of America.
We've certainly seen a lot of projects take longer than initially expected. I think that's a function of the tight labor market.
The current lack of workers, combined with a potential lack of capital, could mean we see fewer construction cranes in the future. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
So I was talking to Catherine up the top about her project trying to figure out why people feel the way they do about this economy. Here's a story that kind of echoes that. Neil King Jr. is a writer. He's a journalist as well. He covered national politics and the economy for The Wall Street Journal for 15 years. But in the spring of 2021, just a couple of months after January 6th, he set out on a walk from his home in Washington, D.C., to Central Park in Manhattan, 300-something miles all told through cities and towns along the way, which has become the subject of his upcoming book. It's called American Ramble, A Walk of Memory and Renewal. Neil, thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
I guess the first question has to be why you decided to take this walk, this ramble.
You know, it stuck in my mind years ago. I live on Capitol Hill, 9 blocks east of the U.S. Capitol, and I just thought one morning, God, what if I just didn't go to Union Station, didn't drive, just walked to New York? How would the pedestrian fit into that territory? You know, it's one of the most trampled, overrun parts of the country. But the more I thought about it, the more I started reading about it, the more I, you know, looked at, like, well, how did George Washington get there for his inauguration? I just became more and more fascinated, and it really dawned on me that a large part of our founding story happens between those two places. What if I just walked out my door and looked at it really slowly and up close and kind of let that territory tell its story? And so that's what I did.
It became, you tell me, but it clearly became a project of yours. And as I said in the introduction, you spent 15-something years as a reporter, and you reported this out as you went to go do it.
I think in a lot of ways it was the most extraordinary sustained act of reporting. And not only was it the kind of advanced reporting where you do a lot of reading, a lot of planning, who are you going to meet, but it was the day-to-day, as you know, serendipitous things that just happened. And there were so many extraordinary things that happened. And then it was playing off of and allowing those things to happen. And so the personal messages and even the kind of parables, I talk about parables, and I realize you become almost kind of biblical when you go on a walk like this. They just started to roll out in front of me.
It is actually really kind of a spiritual book. All right, a couple of anecdotes from a book, honestly, filled with memorable anecdotes. At one point, and this is kind of early on, you're walking through a subdivision and you needed water, and the gentleman with whom you interacted basically said, no, move along. And you write, here's the quote, "We have farmed out our hospitality to the hotel and restaurant industries and all transportation to trains, buses, airplanes, taxis, and Uber. We have sanitized and made a business of the whole of it." That kind of hit me.
You know, if you look at the word hospitality, which goes back to a Greek word that basically means guest, and you look at so many of our, you know, fundamental religions or cultures, there's almost in all of them a foundational, how do you treat the stranger? You give him lodging, you give him food. And, you know, this one young man, I said, you know, do you know where I could get water? He's in front of his house, and he directed me to a store 2 miles away. Kind of the punchline of the story is that I walk for another hour and I fill my water bottle at a Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah. So I kind of had to resort. But on the other hand, I just want to point out, I got so many acts of kindness from so many people along the way. So that was not... representative.
Charity features prominently in this book. I mean, yes, you had set up some of this stuff in advance, but a lot of it was serendipitous and acts of charity and kindness on the part of people you ran into.
The whole idea of pilgrimage, it goes back a long, long way, you know, centuries, millennia. And I really had the feeling that when people talked to me, they asked where I was going, when they knew I was going to a faraway place, a place that felt kind of like the object of a pilgrimage, right? Manhattan, the island of Manhattan. Yeah. They wanted to almost go with me. And their way of going with me was to give me something. And they would give me coffee or a beer or a sandwich or all kinds of things. And that happened throughout. And it was a very spontaneous instinct. And I found that fascinating and actually very gratifying.
There was a clerk at a hotel who heard of what you were doing and pulled two beers out of the refrigerator behind the desk and gave them to you. And it was your only act, you say, of corporate sponsorship, right?
Yeah, I love that. That guy was great. And I was kind of in need of those beers. And he was like, you're doing what? Okay, here.
The physicality of this thing strikes me. You talk a couple of times about getting into a bed at the end of the day and the crisp sheets and standing in a shower and letting the miles run off your legs with the hot water. It was a very physical act.
You know, it was. And I do make a little bit of a kind of joke because I'm thinking a lot about and walking through areas where a lot of agonizing, horrible things happened. And, you know, the night before I went to Valley Forge, which, of course, is our nation's sort of emblematic horror show of endurance and perseverance through a terrible winter, you know, shoeless Continental Army and all that kind of stuff. And the night before I went there, I got into like a bed suitable for five people with, you know, six pillows in it. And, you know, so yeah, I'd walked some serious miles. But on the other hand, we all live pretty cushy existences. And I was very aware of that fact.
Speaking of Valley Forge, you go, you tour, you talk to a guy that you've set up an appointment with, and then you say, I wrapped up the remains of my lunch, walked up to the ridge, and there went, and to see the world rip by, there went an Amazon Prime van, a two-trailer FedEx truck, mere molecules and an endless stream of commerce. I love that. Molecules of commerce.
You know, one of my great encounters, and it was something I put a lot of thought into, was how is I going to encounter and interact with I-95, which at that point was the Jersey Turnpike. Mm-hmm. So I found this perfect place in New Jersey where there were all the Amazon Wayfair, et cetera, warehouses, because that is just the just-in-time locus of the nation. So I found this brook that goes up right between the warehouses, and somebody lends me a kayak. So I'm paddling up this brook unchanged for thousands of years, except for the warehouses. And then I get to I-95, and it's just, of course, a moving sea of just all the stuff that we need, like tomorrow, if not this afternoon. And that was one of the things that was fascinating, that interplay of things that last forever, things that are part of the landscape, and the impatient, need it now, hustle bustle of what America's become.
You said at the beginning of this book, you wanted to see if America was still possible or had seen its best days. And I won't spoil the ending of the book for anybody because it's a journey. You should read it cover to cover. But where'd you come down? Is America still possible?
It is. You know, and I don't want to sort of, there isn't really particularly a spoil alert to alert for really true. Necessarily. But my real message, you know, is that we're at a time right now where I think we're being devoured by abstractions and sort of bogeymen and figments, not entirely of our imagination, but that are being promulgated by a lot of forces. And it's troubling to see it play out. And I know for a fact, having done it, is if you walk out your door with a desire to go to a particular place over a length of time and really just put all that stuff aside and just pay attention, it is a profoundly different America out there. I'm not saying these divisions don't have their reasons and that there aren't a lot of things to be troubled about. There are. But I do think, you know, just the idea of a common ground and actually dealing with people who might not be like you or that you might not share everything in common with, but being in their barn, in their driveway, and dealing with the whole of them, including the things that are charming, despite their politics, just it's a different place. And I think we are losing track of that a little in our desire to be aggravated by things far away. If you look at the up close in an attentive, almost sort of devotional way, the country just tells a different story.
This is a deeply, deeply engaging book. It's called American Ramble, A Walk of Memory and Renewal. Neil King Jr. does it. He also does a website, by the way, called Gotham Canoe, which I also highly recommend. The book is out next week. Neil, thanks a lot.
Huge pleasure, Kai. Great to talk to you.
This final note on the way out today, a quick 1-2 on housing. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index was out today. It showed just a tiny drop month to month, 0.2% nationally, January to February. But it was the 7th straight monthly decline. Mortgage rates is the proximate cause there, of course. Should point out that year over year, home price gains averaged 3.8% nationally. So that's the one. The two of the 1-2 is a survey from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York today that shows consumers expect mortgage rates to hit 8.5% a year from now, 8.8%, 8.8% in 3 years. All right, we're going, not because we want to, but because we got to. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A quick tidbit from that Senate hearing on SVB today. The vice chair of the Fed for supervision, a guy named Michael Barr, was talking about how quickly SVB went under. And he pointed out that on Wednesday of that week, the company announced it was trying to raise some capital. Thursday, a day later, $42 billion in deposits went out the door. That Friday, Barr said $100 billion in deposits was scheduled to be withdrawn. SVB didn't have it, so California state regulators shut them down. That is a very fast and a very big bank run. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Mieten and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.